From the Watson Institute at Brown University, this is Trending Globally. I'm Trending Globally's producer and your guest host, Dan Richards. Since he descended his golden escalator, Trump's nativist, racist, and anti-immigrant rhetoric has been a bit of a shock to the U.S.'s body politic. But the sentiments Trump expresses, and even some of the policies he champions, have existed in America since long before 2016. And if we don't get our act together, Dan Denver believes, they'll stick around long after he's gone. Denver is a journalist, host of the hit podcast The Dig, and a visiting fellow at Watson's Taubman Center. His new book is called All American Nativism: How the Bipartisan War on Immigrants Explains Politics as We Know It. As he illustrates in the book, nativism has played a foundational role in American politics for about as long as we've been a country, despite what many on the left, right, and center claim today. This interview was so wide-ranging that we ended up deciding to break it into two parts. This first episode focuses more on the history of anti-immigrant and nativist attitudes in America. The second part, which will come out next week, looks more at the role nativism plays in our politics today. I started by asking Denver about the initial motivation for writing this book. I'll let him explain it. Here is Dan Denver.
I got the idea to write the book in 2016, around the time that Trump was securing the Republican nomination. And, you know, people were rightfully astounded, disgusted, dismayed. But there was one aspect of the response from many liberal Trump critics that really bothered me, which was the idea, and is still today, the idea that this is not normal. The idea that Trump was an entire abnormality, I thought was exemplary of the liberal and establishment Republican inability to understand their own complicity in Trump's rise. It was Trump's bipartisan predecessors, American politics at its most normal for the past few decades, that built the institutions and passed the laws that were used to repress, deport, and brutalize immigrants for decades, and that now Trump wields to such disastrous effects.
Yeah, and I want to get into that more recent history, but I want to start a little farther back. One of the things you do so well in this book is show just how long mainstream American politics has lived with this idea that we have a, quote, immigration problem. And you show in the book how this problem was socially constructed. And there's this really interesting turning point you cover. I think it was maybe right after the Civil War.
Yeah.
Where the language even started changing from an emigrant with an E to an immigrant. And that this new word started to develop a particular negative connotation.
Yeah, I have to credit Donna Gabaccia, a historian, an immigration historian who has written powerfully on this subject, and it's remarkable work, because what it shows is that until the late 19th century, that the term wasn't immigrant, it was emigrant. And that's not just semantics. The word emigrant was used both to describe people who were coming from Europe to the Eastern Seaboard, major emigrant receiving cities like Boston and New York, and it was also used tellingly for people moving from the Eastern Seaboard, regardless of where they were born, out to the expanding Western frontier. And that's because the U.S. was very explicitly at that time, as it was before the country's formal foundation in the late 18th century, was a explicitly settler colonial project. So the term immigrant only really came into widespread use, Donna Gabaccia shows, in the late 19th century, when immigration becomes conceived of as a problem because of the rise of anti-Chinese sentiment that accompanies the closing of the Western frontier. There was the sense that the Western frontier was an endless escape valve for all of the contradictions of American capitalism and society. And when that closed, a sense of scarcity emerged and actual economic crises. And it was Chinese workers who had come to build the Transcontinental Railroad and do all kinds of other work who were blamed. And so that is the moment when immigrant as a negative term really starts to emerge, and it begins to also be applied not only to other Asians. Chinese are banned in 1882, and then other Asian nationals are banned in the decades that follow, pretty much comprehensively by the early 20s. So immigration is identified and begins to be made into a problem as such. And after immigration is identified as a problem, the solution to that gradually over the following decades is to first target and exclude non-white, specifically Asian immigrants, and then to start subdividing white immigrants into all of these categories of superiority and inferiority, and sharply restricting immigration from everywhere outside of the Western Hemisphere, save primarily from England, Ireland, and Germany. And this presents a problem, which is that U.S. business demands labor.
This period you're discussing right now is when we had these sort of explicitly race-based quotas, right?
Yeah. Nationality-based, but nationality as a subcategory or pretext for race.
Right.
We had explicitly racist immigration laws in this country from the first Naturalization Act passed in the late 18th century. I don't remember the year, just after the revolution, which opened citizenship to all free white people, to 1965, when the national origins quotas passed in the 1920s were abolished. From the beginning to 1965, we have explicitly racist immigration policy.
Right. So it is just clearly baked in a way that many people don't know or would rather not really think about.
Yeah, it's kind of wild that people don't know, too, because I mean, the only people who tend to know are the hardcore critics of American immigration policy from the left, from the immigrant rights.
Right.
People coming from immigrant rights perspective, and the hardcore critics of the immigration status quo from the right, who are very aware of this history. And people like Stephen Miller are extraordinary, and Jeff Sessions, extraordinarily enthusiastic about returning to the national origins quotas era. That's what they like. That was good for them.
And we'll get back to them in a little bit. But I kind of wanted to now jump to the 1960s, where there's some real transformations in how immigration worked in the U.S. So I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about both the Bracero program and what was the significance of its ending, as well as the Hart-Celler Act. And I'll let you explain them and how they kind of intersect to create the world that might be more familiar to listeners today.
Yeah, so there's a lot of history there, and I guess
yes.
I mean, I think the place I have to start is where I just ended, which is the National Origins Quotas Acts passed throughout the 1920s. The reason they were able to happen, according to political scientist Daniel Teichner, is because business, a crucial defender of immigration, because they like to exploit immigrant labor, they defected from the pro-immigrant coalition during the first Red Scare, which was a World War I era campaign of demonization and repression that was simultaneously anti-Bolshevik and anti-immigrant. And the politics, the political tumult of that moment gave nativists unprecedented space, political space, to push through these restrictions. But that didn't mean that business was just like, okay, we're not going to have cheap labor to exploit. Instead, they looked to Mexico, especially because with the labor shortages provoked by World War II, what business did is, with in cooperation with the U.S. and Mexican government, institute something called the Bracero program.
This is the only area in which the American farm labor supply falls short. All such farm jobs, which are tough, dirty, or unpleasant, is supplemented by Mexican citizens. But the term most commonly used is braceros.
Which brought millions of Mexican guest workers, ostensibly to labor for a temporary period of time for a specific contract, and then return. But that whole model, of course, operates upon this fantastical idea that you can simultaneously have people in your polity, in your country, as workers, but not as full humans, including as citizens of that polity, who have families and civic power and responsibility. and that there'll be no contradiction between having people as workers but not humans. By the 1960s, the immigration status quo was under a lot of stress.
What do they want? A union, a contract, a living wage, the right to negotiate their wages.
On the one hand, the Bracero program was incredibly exploitative and abusive and came under a lot of criticism from organized labor and advocates for very good reason. And so that came to an end in 1964. But the National Origins Quota Act was also under a huge amount of stress. Suddenly, kind of ordinary, explicitly racist policy that was okay for long periods of American history was no longer.
Right. This was the same time as the civil rights movement.
Yeah. And people of white ethnics, people, Italian Americans, Polish Americans, were being more fully incorporated as white Americans. And part of that was celebrating their immigrant roots rather than demonizing them or hiding them because they were un-American. So these laws targeting a subset of white Americans with racial stigma were untenable. These racist immigration laws were also untenable for the same reason that Jim Crow in the South was becoming untenable, which is that the geopolitical context had radically changed. The U.S. was in a Cold War with the Soviet Union, and these two superpowers were competing for the affections of decolonizing nations all over the world who didn't take it as very complimentary when their nationals were targeted for exclusion because of their purported inferiority. And so in 1965, the year after the Bracero program came to the end, LBJ, Lyndon Johnson, President Johnson, signed the Hart-Celler Act, which eliminated the national origins quotas.
This bill says simply that from this day forth, those wishing to immigrate to America shall be admitted on the basis of their skills and their close relationships to those already here.
And for the first time in a long time, U.S. immigration policy was facially racially neutral. But there were a lot of very national and racial particularities embedded within that neutrality. First of all, for the first time ever, an overall cap on immigration from the Western Hemisphere was imposed. But then even more critically was, I believe it was 1976, that universal visa caps were placed on every country in the world. I believe it was 20,000 visas annually per country, whether that country was Mexico or Belgium.
Right.
It didn't matter. And so it was facially, racially neutral, but in fact, incredibly discriminatory because there was a deeply integrated labor market at that point, tying Mexico to the U.S. and deeply ingrained patterns and systems of Mexican labor migration that were woven into the economies and societies and, until the end of the Bracero program, the laws of the two countries. And so what happened in the 60s and 70s is that Mexican migration, labor migration, continued much as it had before. What changed was U.S. government policy, which suddenly declared that entire pre-existing stream of ordinary and, in fact, invited Mexican labor migration, declared it illegal, illegalized it, which helped make Mexican migrants into the iconic illegal immigrant and made illegal immigration, quote unquote, into the core problem of immigration.
Right. It seems like you see that this pressure cooker is just getting set where, for some series of reasons, this type of migration and travel is being made illegal. But at the same time, it is absolutely essential for the functioning of our country's economy as we know it.
Yeah. And those two things are going to come to a head at some point. Like our economic system is demanding this labor and set the whole process into motion. And then but on the political level, we're denying it and saying, no, we're rejecting it. We're saying this is an invasion. This is something we want to keep out. That's a contradiction. And contradictions eventually cause trouble. And that's the story of the 70s to Donald Trump.
Right. And at this same time, in like the 70s, another factor gets put into this pressure cooker that was really like one of the wildest parts of this book and one of the wildest histories, which was, you know, you say how a lot of the really hardcore nativism that came up at that time was not coming from maybe some of the circles or subcultures you would expect. I wonder if you could tell us about one of the main sources of nativist sentiment from that era.
Yeah. So the same moment that sees the end of the Bracero program and the signing of the Hart-Celler Act and the reimagining, the false reimagining of this country as a nation of immigrants, the 1960s, is it a moment of a certain optimism and an expansive vision of what is possible in the United States and the world. This is LBJ's Great Society moment, you know, where he calls for, quote, an order of plenty for all of our people, directed to, quote, elevate our national life and to advance the quality of our American civilization. Just incredibly lofty vision of what's possible. And that all blows up very soon after. The war in Vietnam shows the sharp limits of American military power, and the economic crises of the 1970s bring the long period of enormous post-war growth to a grinding, sudden halt. And then begins the attacks on labor and the wage stagnation that we've seen from the 70s to this current day. Everything goes from like the most rosy, optimistic, utopian vision to the sense that the world is a bad place where everyone has to look out for themselves, with scarce resources that each person and nation is in a zero-sum game to control. This is also the moment when modern environmental consciousness really emerges. And a lot of that is a good thing, obviously. But one of the major focuses of environmentalism in this period is not about any particular polluting industry. It's not about the oil industry or the chemical industry or logging companies. It's obsessed with human population, with so-called overpopulation. And the Bible of this population hysteria is a 1968 bestseller by Paul Ehrlich, The Population Bomb, which warns that rapid human population growth, if left unchecked, would just lead to massive famine, chaos, misery, catastrophe. And this is accepted as
gospel.
As gospel.
Scientific truth.
Yeah, as gospel. Scientific truth by just extraordinary numbers. And this guy, an ophthalmologist from Michigan named John Tanton, goes on in 1979 to found a group called the Federation for American Immigration Reform, or FAIR. And over the following years, he goes on to found basically every single significant national anti-immigrant organization in this country that is with us to this day. FAIR, the Center for Immigration Studies, U.S. English, Numbers USA.
Is more always better? The United States Congress seems to believe that more is always better. But you can have too much of a good thing. Take immigration numbers, for instance.
He either directly or had a role in founding all of those.
That is such a disturbing thing for anyone who considers themselves like an environmentalist or deeply concerned about Earth's resources. Just knowing that history. And, you know, you write, there's a great quote of someone who I think had a discussion with Tanton, where they were like, yeah, everything he kind of described about, you know, scarcity and ecological, you know, caring for the environment and all these things, it was all sort of making sense, but just at the end, you just felt like you wanted to take a shower.
Yeah.
There's just something about it that is not right.
Yeah, he did an amazing job mainstreaming racist anti-immigrant politics, but kept getting himself in trouble by saying extremely racist white nationalist things. An irony that I end my book on in terms of this origins, this ecological, environmentalist, populationist origin story, is that ironically, the problem was never just, was never the poor, racialized others who were targeted, have been targeted by anti-immigrant politics. It was always the wealthiest people in the wealthiest nations who produce the vast majority of carbon that is setting this planet on the path to climate catastrophe. And now it's precisely the sort of nationalism and xenophobia that the anti-immigrant movement has played such a key role in making central to American identity and politics that poses the greatest threat to addressing global warming. It's that precise type of politics that poses the biggest obstacle to engaging in the sort of unprecedented global cooperation that we need to avert climate catastrophe.
Right. And it cuts to, I think, the point you sort of like underscore so well throughout the book, which is that, you know, in the, especially in the 90s, and as we've seen in the last few decades, there was a consensus about immigration between our two mainstream political parties that we had an immigration problem primarily. That was the foundational like premise, was we have an immigration problem and it needs to be solved with some types of enforcement and deportation and policing of people who come in and out of this country. This consensus that started to exist, and I think in some ways an escalation of anti-immigration policies. How did that consensus come to exist in the 90s, and what defined it?
Yeah, so the idea that immigration is a problem, we've talked about how that developed in the late 19th century, but it again becomes a sort of problem, establishes a sort of problem with the mass illegalization of Mexican immigrants that I mentioned earlier in the 1960s and 70s. And there's all kinds of efforts in the 1980s, notably the 1986 Immigration Reform and Control Act, this massive bill that both legalizes, I think, about 2.7 million mostly Mexican undocumented workers, but also provides for sanctions against employers who hire undocumented immigrants, which FAIR and other anti-immigrant advocates hope will finally shut off the demand, the business demand for undocumented immigrants. That doesn't work because the employer sanctions are toothless. The nativists are right about that. So immigration politics is already an enormous deal in the 1980s, but the partisan conflict over immigration and this sort of competition over escalating crackdowns on immigrants and the borders really emerges in the 1990s, when IRCA, the 1986 bill, quote unquote, doesn't work. And there's still huge numbers of people crossing the border without authorization at a time when there's a post-Cold War economic downturn in the early 1990s, at a time when NAFTA is being negotiated and American workers, two decades in to stagnating wages, are incredibly anxious about their place in an ever more global economy. And what happens in the early 1990s is two key events. First, in El Paso, Texas, the Border Patrol sector's first Hispanic Border Patrol's chief, Sylvester Reyes, does something sort of renegade and concentrates all of the agents in his sector in downtown El Paso, where for years, undocumented people had commuted back and forth between Juarez and El Paso. It wasn't so much a site for migrating into the United States permanently without documentation, but part of the daily life of a two-city transnational border metropolis. But what happens when he does that is he does shut down this massive, ordinary, undocumented crossing point. And what that action does is seemingly prove that what was thought to be impossible is in fact entirely possible, and that the border can be secured. That was called Operation Hold the Line. Around the same time in 1994, anti-immigrant activists in California put a measure on the ballot called Proposition 187 that would deny all social services to undocumented immigrants, including public education. Extremely draconian bill.
They keep coming. 2 million illegal immigrants in California. The federal government won't stop them at the border, yet requires us to pay billions to take care of them.
At first, it doesn't get very much attention, but this is a time when the war on crime is taking off, and the stigmatization of people on public benefits as parasites who are taking money from hardworking taxpayers. But the war on crime and anti-welfare politics are becoming central to the Republican right. But it's not just Republicans. Seeing what happened in El Paso.
That's why our administration has moved aggressively to secure our borders more by hiring a record number of new border guards, by deporting twice as many criminal aliens as ever before, by cracking down on illegal hiring, by barring welfare benefits to illegal aliens. In the budget I will
Bill Clinton's
to you, we will
administration begins to expand the model across the border and, in fact, deploys the same model from El Paso in San Diego, in California, even though Bill Clinton, the Clinton administration, officially opposes Proposition 187. He's also engaging in a spectacular militarization of the border just before the vote on it to say the Clinton administration has the border under control.
We are a nation of immigrants, but we are also a nation of laws.
But what it actually also does is says yes, the right wing is correct. There is a crisis at the border. So for the right, this was a useful culture war issue, but it was also a useful culture war issue for the new Democrats, who did not want the debate to be over NAFTA. They wanted the debate to be over crime, welfare, illegal immigration. And that was a basic point of consensus between the right and the left. And that basic point of consensus had an escalatory conflict logic embedded within it, because if both of them agreed that these were the problems and these were the basic outlines of the solutions, then the competition was over who was most effectively tough against illegal, quote unquote, illegal immigration. By the end of the 90s, there's so much border militarization and the economy starts to boom again that immigration, which was just such a central issue in the early and mid 90s, all but disappears from American political debate. It's really remarkable. It's not discussed in a single debate between Al Gore and George W. Bush in 2000. Not discussed, period. Then that all changes after 9/11.
And I've ordered that the full resources of the federal government go to help the victims and their families, and to conduct a full-scale investigation to hunt down and to find those folks who committed this act.
Thanks for listening to part one of our conversation with Dan Denver. It was produced by me, Dan Richards, and Jackson Cantrell. Our theme music is by Henry Bloomfield. Additional music by the Blue Dot Sessions. You can find more episodes just like this by subscribing to us, Trending Globally, on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And if you haven't listened to Dan Denver's podcast, The Dig, definitely subscribe to that while you're at it. He has incredible conversations with brilliant thinkers, and listening to it will make you a smarter, better person. For more information about this show and other podcasts produced by the Watson Institute, go to watson.brown.edu. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week for another episode of Trending Globally.